Esther 8, verses 15 through 17. Esther 8, 15 to 17. And Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and with a great crown of gold, and with a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. And many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. Ahasuerus the king has very wisely, he set limits upon the impending violence that has been stirred up by that decree, that wicked decree of Haman. As noted before, the principle of lex talionis, that is an eye for an eye, actually prescribes equitable limits in a world plunged into sin. I know Gandhi said that in a world where there's an eye for an eye, everyone would be blind. But in a world where there are no limits to justice or the seeking of justice, everyone would be dead. By setting limits, it fixes events in a manner that tends to keep them within the boundaries of justice. The sinfulness of men makes the thirst for vengeance unquenchable. And that's why this is such a necessary thing. Vengeance, when it's left to its own devices, when there's nothing to hem it in, when there's nothing to put a stop to it, vengeance knows no limits. Vengeance perceives no excesses. Vengeance is such a problem that even men who are unrenewed by grace often discern in the law a necessary barrier to unchecked acts of retaliation, which, apart from the imposition of real justice, it tends to escalate until feuds become wars, and as I alluded to a moment ago, the earth is drenched in blood. Now, to be just, the response must be several things. It must be proportional. It must be equitable. And it must be timely. You see, anything that is out of proportion is only going to evoke bloodlust on the other side, the desire for continued revenge. Anything that's not equitable is going to leave one party in this equation with some sense of injustice. And that's very likely going to stir up feelings of bitterness and resentment that will be nourished and grow. Anything that's not timely will fail adequately to connect the transgression with its punishment, and thereby it will diminish or obliterate any sense of justice having been done. There is a saying, justice delayed is justice denied. What is important here is this. Ahasuerus is not allowing things to exceed the bounds of true justice, nor, and this is very important, nor is he going to suffer this justice to be delayed. Thus, then, besides giving fair warning, warning leading up to the date that this is all going to come to pass, the king, at the request of Esther and Mordecai, gives the Jews legal cover for exercising self-defense upon the day in question. In fact, they're allowed to prepare their own defense, and on the appointed day, and only on that appointed day, they're allowed to exercise themselves in that defense. Now, as I noted before, the 13th day of every month was called by the Persians Tir. And that meant that it was associated with the lot. Now, for the unbeliever, the lot embodies the element of chance or fortune or fate. It embodies the sense of a personless providence, if you will. A guidance that is without any respect for anything or anyone. It's just chance. But the Persians would have perceived this to be the day when the fates were most likely to smile upon their undertakings, whatever they would be. In fact, they not only called the day Tir, they also referred to the 13th day of every month as what they would call an auspicious day. A day of great expectation. And so Haman cast lots upon the 13th day in Nisan, the first month. And it fell on that day in the month Adar, the 12th month. Now, for the heathen, then, having the smiles of fortune or chance, those are the best indicators they have of success. Beyond the success itself. Right? They really don't have any sense of assurance that there is a divine presence actively seeking their good. But you see, while the heathen are looking at the lot that way, for the Jews, and I would say for Christians, and the reason we are or ought to be so concerned about the diminution and profanation of the lot is that, among other things, the lot and the use of the lot signifies a surrendering of a matter to a force beyond one's own control or comprehension. That is God. And there's another dimension to this, I think, if we think about it. And the Jews do talk about this when they talk about lots. They're aware of this. For them, it meant surrendering to God, confessing that no man is worthy in the sight of God, and acknowledging that if he will save us, it will be a matter of his own good pleasure. It's not going to be the result of weighing Israel in a scale to determine whether or not to save. Whether or not there's some merit or demerit going on here. For the faithful Jews, then, this should have been enough assurance of what was to come, knowing that the 13th day was the day of the lot. Because, you see, God, they knew this, they should have at least, because Moses tells them this in Deuteronomy. God didn't choose Israel because they were better people. God didn't choose Israel because they were more numerous people than other nations. The fact is, they were not. God's choosing of Israel was not based upon any of their merits or demerits. It was purely a matter of his grace. And isn't that what it is with when you cast the lot? Think about that. There's no merit or demerit. All of that goes out the window at that point. Right? It's not determinative. Your merit or demerit is not determinative of the outcome of the lot. The outcome of the lot is outside of that control. The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing is of the Lord. And the people of God can be glad of that. Now this leads us to the question that would be presented to the Jews and to Haman then when the lot fell upon Adar. Both are going to have to ask this question. Was Moses rising or falling? Remember, Adar was the month in which Moses was born and in which he died. Now, for Haman, the fact that Moses died in this month, the fact that the Jews had no particular feast, nothing special, nothing going for them in that month, Haman looked at that and he said, ah, this is an auspicious day. This is a consequential day. And it seems to him to convey a sense, an assured sense, of the doom that awaits the Jews. But I would suggest to you that if you were a faithful Jew, Moses' birth would carry more significance. After all, think about this. Moses, when he died, he's buried by God. There is no emphasis put on the remembrance of the death of Moses. But his birth, well, that's a different story, isn't it? In his birth, there's a lot that we know about his birth, how he was cast out into that ark of reeds and then drawn out and being put in the house of Pharaoh, Pharaoh's daughter taking him and so on, raising him. If you're a Jew, a faithful Jew, Moses' birth, I think, would seem to be most determinative. And so I think with this new edict now drawn up under the hand of Mordecai, they would especially have reason to see this is not Moses falling, but Moses rising. And I think that's one reason why in the history of the Jews recognize Mordecai to be a man, a prophet, second only to Moses in importance. Under Mordecai, Moses is rising again. Under Mordecai, Moses is going to rise to reestablish the nation of the Jews. Now, the care with which this new decree was sent forth is also noted, as the text in the verses before our verses actually contrasts it with the first decree. If you were to look at the text and compare, there are very obvious parallelisms observable which invite us here at this point to recall the first edict and contemplate its relation to the second edict. In many respects, what happened the first time is being repeated. But it's the dissimilarities that tell a different story. Now, Ahasuerus, in his desire to lavish greater and greater rewards upon Mordecai, appears very forward to make certain that Haman's decree is not merely blunted, but that it is effectively going to be overthrown. And I would suggest that there's a note of that which Paul says in Romans 5 here. Remember, Paul says, when, moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound, he says, but where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. So there is this idea, I think, of an abounding of grace where this law, the first edict, had in fact, where it had entered, and the offense had abounded. And I say this because I think it's particularly true if we're looking at the parallelisms. There are specific additions to these verses you don't find in the earlier, because in the earlier the Jews are ignored altogether because they're going to be wiped out. But in this, the Jews are told to make themselves ready against the 13th of Adar, that 12th month. And this is a special provision then for the elect people of God, which is being held forth with what I would call a note of graciousness by the king. Now, the thoroughness with which this new edict was copied and sent is also, I think, a very good indication that its contents were as thorough to reverse the effects of the previous edict as the first had been to grant such a wicked license to the enemies of the Jews. Moreover, I would say this, that the haste with which these copies of the new decree were dispatched throughout the kingdom conveys a sense of gravity. The situation is grave. There's an urgency and there's an importance that is attached to these copies. And so they're moving quickly. For the Jews, this represents a legal grant to take certain, even not just defensive, but in some respects, preemptive steps in their own defense. For the king, this, I think, represents a genuine attempt on his part to rectify a great wrong which had been permitted to take place largely due to the influence of his wicked prime minister, Haman. Now, I say largely because there has been some discussion as to whether or not Ahasuerus was just a thoroughly wicked man. But whatever the case might have been early on in the book of Esther, his attitude seems to have changed dramatically since she's come before him to make petition for the people of Israel. And finally, before I get into the verses at the end of this chapter, I made a few brief comments last time about the decree issuing forth from Shushan the palace. How unusual it might have been to them. Certainly, how unexpected to have a sense of the deliverance of the people coming from the very center of the place where their condemnation had begun. The name Shushan means lily. And the lily was the symbol of springtime. So Shushan, by extension, refers to springtime. And actually, in the titles of the Psalms, you may recall this phrase, upon Shoshanim. That title is attached to two of the Psalms. The Hebrew word there, al, could mean as well concerning Shoshanim. Shoshanim is the plural of lilies. And there is some thought, and I think with some merit, that these Psalms are particularly associated with the Passover. There are a couple of other psalms that are concerning Shoshanim Iduth, that is, lilies of the testimony. And that those psalms seem to have some reference to Pentecost. Now, my purpose is not to defend that position here, but to point out that these two feasts are actually the feasts of the springtime. And they represent, first of all, the Passover represents the deliverance of Israel from Egypt. And second, the Pentecost. Pentecost represents the establishment of Israel in the Promised Land, particularly if you remember, it is associated with the giving of the law. Now, I want you to remember this then. The second edict was sent forth in the month Sivan, the month when Pentecost began, on the sixth day. The initial decree had gone forth right around the time of Passover. For the Jews then, being reminded that the name of the Persian palace was tied, at least linguistically, to their Passover and to Pentecost, that too, I think, is a little bit of an indication that they should have been stirred up to both faith and hope. They could look at this now in light of the second edict and say, aha, so many times in the Bible, prophecies are not necessarily clear until they're fulfilled. But now, having the second decree, you can begin to look back and say, here was Passover and Pentecost, and here's what is transpiring. This second decree is going to establish us. There's a giving of the law. You know, there's been a redemption from this first decree, and now the giving of the law. The palace, of course, had been the place where Haman had tried to bury the Jews. But I think now we begin to see that trying to curse the Jews, whom God had not cursed, that was a futile effort. It's very much reminiscent, if you go back in the book of Numbers and remember Balaam, when he was asked to curse the Jews, he discovered that he was unable to curse them. The first edict then, that of Haman, which was made as the Jews were preparing to celebrate Passover, that made the redemption necessary. But the second edict, as I'm suggesting, that of Mordecai's, promises to establish them as a nation once more just after they had celebrated Pentecost. And the Jews do think about these things as they're going through this. Additionally, come the month of Adar, remember, the month of Adar would be the month when they would be recalling that plague of darkness which fell upon the Egyptians just prior to the deliverance. Now, why do I bring up all of this? What I'm trying to say is this. All in all, for those with eyes of faith, for those who have eyes to see, everything actually should seem to be getting better and better. If you're a Jew who has faith, it should be getting better. At least it should seem that way. Verse 15 then. And Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and with a great crown of gold, and with a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. And Mordecai went out. I want you to recall that not long before this time, Mordecai had been outside of the palace. In fact, he had been unable to enter the palace because he was in a state of mourning. Now, Mordecai goes out having secured the necessary means for the deliverance of the Jews. And how quickly his outward station had changed. As one commentator has rightly noted upon this place, we should never say in our prosperity we shall never be moved. Let us never say in the day of adversity that our eyes shall never see more good. Or whatever our outward condition may be, let us not despair of obtaining those changes in our outward condition which the Redeemer, whom we are called to trust, has accomplished in innumerable instances. The Lord anointed him to comfort all that mourn and to give unto them the oil of joy for mourning and the garments of praise for the spirit of heaviness. And that's what we're going to see is what happens here. There is, in fact, a very interesting parallel with the language. The language here is paralleled in the gospel. When Jesus is led out to be crucified. So there's a contrast, I think, that is being drawn in the gospel with that of Mordecai here. But of that, that belongs really to the gospel. But Mordecai, unlike Jesus, Mordecai is not being led forth to be mocked, but he's being led forth to be honored, and he's being brought forth to see victory. The first time, remember, that Mordecai went out from the palace court, he did so with Haman, the enemy of the Jews, breathing out threats and promising destruction. That time, as he went out, it appeared that he was on the brink of utter defeat. If you were a supporter of Mordecai, you probably were going to distance yourself from him, because in Persian society, when someone in the court goes down, anyone who is associated with him, thought to be a loyalist of his, is probably going to suffer in that turnabout too. This time, however, he goes forth victorious. Haman's decree, though it's not been rescinded, it has, practically speaking, it's been overthrown by the second edict. Where his old enemy had previously found favor with the king, Mordecai now walks in the king's favor, and that's reflected in what follows. And by the way, I would invite you to keep comparing this first decree with that broken covenant of works and the second decree with the covenant of grace. Because there are a number of similarities going on here. Anyhow, Mordecai went out from the presence of the king. Now, this phrase, from the presence of the king, this, again, gives a not-so-subtle hint of Mordecai's newfound favor. The Hebrew literally says here, he went forth from before the face of the king. In other words, he had been in the presence of the king, standing there with favor before him. That's the idea. He was countenanced. We use that term, and that word countenance, you know, your face is your countenance. When you countenance someone, you are, in fact, receiving them with favor, and that's linguistically the idea that's going on here. He had been countenanced by the king. Right? Now the first time because of Haman, remember he'd been driven from the presence of the king. But now he goes forth from the king voluntarily and with his apparent blessing. And there are differences, and there are important differences that, as we're going to see. Previously, he'd been driven from the outer court and cast down. But this time, he's walking triumphantly from the inner court, having been elevated to the highest rank in the kingdom beside the king. And here I think is an important note of difference between the first and second decrees when they're made. If you recall, after the making of that first decree, Haman and the king both sit down to drink and celebrate. Why do they do that? Well, there is, I think, amongst a lot of heathens, a sense of fatalism. And I think that Haman was a fatalist who presumed that everything now was as good as accomplished. I have this decree. Remember, that decree, that law or custom of the Medes and Persians, it can't be changed. So he must have thought within himself, I've done well. I've accomplished my mission. You know, they're just awaiting execution, but they're done for now, the Jews. Probably thought, what could possibly derail his plot to destroy all the Jews? He has this irrevocable decree, and all of his lot casting, and all of the events leading up to that moment, if you remember, right before he found himself being led to the gallows, from his point of view, it all seemed to be giving him greater and greater assurance of victory. And so now, when he's got the decree, of course, there's good reason from his point of view to just sit back and say, ah, relax and let fate have its course. Now that fatalistic sense is what moved Haman from sending forth his decree to such a quick celebrating of what he thought was victory. Moreover, Haman gives no indication whatsoever that the thought of casting so many tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people into misery or despair, that has ever crossed his mind. Not at all. Now I want you to contrast that with Mordecai. Although Mordecai's decree would undo the most caustic features of Haman's decree, Mordecai is not content to let things slip. He's not a fatalist. It's true, he's assured that there is a God, and that God is superintending the safety of Israel. Mordecai believes in predestination. Mordecai knows that there is a personal providence. He knows that Israel is going to be delivered, but remember what he said to Esther, you know, if you're not going to do this, deliverance may come from another quarter. And Mordecai goes forth then, not presumptuous that his decree is simply going to be fulfilled, but he goes forth to make sure that that decree will be fulfilled. He, unlike Haman, doesn't lay down his trust once he gets his edict. Because you see, that's essentially what Haman did. And Haman, once he got that edict, he said, now I can put down my crown and I can party like there is no tomorrow for the Jews. Mordecai, instead, and in contrast, goes forth with the mission to carry out his trust as the Persian prime minister, the grand vizier. And he now has the confidence of the king, and he has a means to see that justice really does prevail in the kingdom. And that's his job. He's not going to let this fail because of something he failed to do. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white. The word translated blue is a word that could refer to violet. What we see, first of all, then, is this. Mordecai now is clad in what is known as royal apparel. Now, contrast that. At the time of the decree of Haman, he had rent his clothes and put on sackcloth. Now, we see him going forth wrapped in royal attire. There's a contrast, and it's deliberate. Here is the beginning of the list of the various ornaments placed upon him, because the king, you see, had advanced him to such high estate, a place of very notable power and trust in the Persian kingdom. Now, here's what we know about the attire of the Persian monarchy. The Persian monarch generally wore a purple robe with an inner vest of purple striped with blue. And that's what this is talking about. Strabo, the Greek philosopher and historian, he describes this uniform. Now, Strabo lives right around the time of Christ. He lives most of his life prior to the time of Christ, but he dies sometime early in Christ's life. So that's his time frame. But he describes this uniform. He says, they, that is the princes, have a lined robe with sleeves down to the knees. Inside, he says, it's white. Outside, he says, it's violet blue. In the summer, in addition to this, he says, they wear a mantle of purple, but in winter, it's of a variegated color or blue. So why the blue or violet and white, or purple and white? These are the state colors of the Persian kingdom. And I think I mentioned that much, much earlier in this book. Now, usually, when the Persian kings gave robes of honor to their various court favorites, they gave them robes, according to Xenophon, the robes were generally of a single tint throughout. However, we're told here that the one given to Mordecai seems to reflect the very colors that the king himself would wear. Now, the colors have reference to the Persian religious views of the world. White is the color of light. Blue is the color of the sky, and purple of the sun. And if you say, well, that sounds odd, first of all, as I noted very early on in the book when we were talking about it, these are colors reflected in the Hebrew tabernacle as well. And let me just say that I think the notion here is that the king, now Mordecai, are in some sense clothed with the authority of heaven. But white is at one end of the spectrum. For the other end of the spectrum, they saw fire and the scarlet that was in fire. There are astronomers who will tell you that when we see the blue sky, it's really only a defect in our vision that we don't see the sky really as purple. Philip Schaff, the German Reformed church historian and theologian of the 19th century, has noted that in Scripture, purple is the color of God's transcendence, whereas blue is the color of his condescending majesty. And that makes, I think, some sense. If you think about that, the notion is this: when the rays of the sun come into the atmosphere of the earth, we have all of the colors in the white light, But on the one end, where the sun is closest, you get this very deep blue at the height of the afternoon sun. And at the far end of the sun rays, you see the oranges and the reds. So you're at the other end of that spectrum. All that spectrum is in between. So as it comes through the air, it's being separated, and that's what's going on. Well, somehow or other, perhaps through playing with prisms or something, the Persians apparently were actually aware that the light as it was coming in was this violet, this dark violet. So they were taken up with that color, and it is associated with royalty. In large part, it is, if you remember, I think I mentioned that purples were made using the shells of certain shellfish, and it was for a long time, purple dye was actually more valuable than gold, which is why only kings wore it. Here it is, you have Mordecai with this purple. And you have him, as it were, clothed with the authority of heaven. And whether or not the Persians see this, what we should understand is this. There is here, then, actually that kind of redemption that covenanters talk about of civil magistracy, isn't there? In other words, civil magistracy is founded in nature, but it is elevated by grace. It's not a different government. It's still represented by this white and purple. But now Mordecai is wearing this white and purple. And through the power of true religion, he is elevating the magistrate of the Persian Empire, the magistracy of the Persian Empire. So it's not magistracy is not founded in grace, but grace, in fact, does elevate, purify, sanctify, and, make magistracy function as it should have and would have if there had not been a fall into sin. So he goes forth now from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white and with a great crown of gold. Now I want you to again note the contrast. He had the first time he went forth, he put on his head ashes, and he's wearing sackcloth and ashes. Here he has a crown of gold. You know, we have to tweak the language a little bit to understand what's going on. Whereas the clothing might have reflected the king, the crown was not the tall one like Ahasuerus or Xerxes or any Persian king would have worn. This was a particular kind worn by Persian nobles that was meant to distinguish him from the king. He's not the king, but he has all the authority of the king, according to that robe, that royal apparel he's wearing. When the king had asked Haman what should be done to the man the king wanted to honor, Haman, of course, thinking it was himself, thinking who else could be deserving or worthy of such an honor, it has to be me, he replied that the king should put his crown, the crown which the king alone could wear, upon that man. The word here used, however, shows that what the king gave Mordecai was not the royal crown. The Greek word would be, I think, sedaris. The Hebrew word for the crown is kithar, I believe. But what this is something different. It's a different word that's used here. It's something more like a golden tiara. You know what a tiara is? It's a woven golden wreath. If you've ever seen those pictures of Roman noblemen, where they have, it looks like a little crown wrapping around their heads with leaves in it. That's the sort of thing, that's a tiara, that's what they would have worn. And this this simple princely usage of the tiara would have been enough to avoid having people confuse him for the king. So it has to be done. So he goes forth, went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel, blue and white, with a great crown of gold, and with a garment of fine linen and purple. Now, we're told here that Mordecai is dressed with fine linen, which was white and purple. So it's, again, these colors of white and purple. And these are the kingly colors, that white and purple stripe that actually represented. Remember, the Persian religion is very much tied up with this idea of the struggle between light and darkness, between good and evil. And that's reflected in what these kings, these monarchs would wear. But the garment here, he actually refers to this outer garment, which was a kind of royal turban called a diadem. And it was attached to that tiara encircling the lower part of the crown. So this is a cloth piece that goes on the tiara and hangs about the head. And this too has those royal colors. This is quite unusual that he would have been allowed to wear these. But Mordecai is allowed to wear the colors of the king so long as he doesn't challenge the king's authority in matters of state. Now again, it's amazing to consider, isn't it, that Haman's advice, fueled by his own ambition, had led to his own demise. But it had also provided the model for the reward that Mordecai, who was his archenemy, would actually receive at the hand of the king. You know, when Haman said, "Let the man whom the king delighteth to honor be clothed in royal apparel," he didn't mean merely that he should be arrayed in such costly robes as the king himself might not have been ashamed to wear, but he meant in the robes precisely of the same kind as the king was accustomed to wear. And that's exactly what we see happening here with Mordecai now. So he goes forth in royal apparel of blue and white and with a great crown of gold and with a garment of fine linen and purple. And we're told next, the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. Again, this is contrasting. If you remember in chapter 3, verse 15, after the first decree, the city of Shushan, we're told, was perplexed. But now they're said to rejoice. The word actually means here that they cried out loud. They cried aloud. Such was their reception then. It appears there was some kind of public rejoicing going on. Now, I would suggest it may well be that the constant overreach of Haman had made him enemies in all the quarters of the city. It's very likely those who silently complied and bowed every time Haman moved from place to place. Remember that? Every time Haman went out, you had to bow down. So it got Mordecai in trouble. It's probably likely that even though a lot of these people didn't say a word, once Mordecai takes Haman's place, once Haman's gone, that those people are going to be very overjoyed to be finished with him. Right? In fact, they already are going to understand that unlike Haman, Mordecai, when he goes forth, he doesn't require all the people to bow down and show this kind of slavish devotion and have that lavished upon him. There's no indication of that. So everyone in Shushan, especially, as we're going to see with respect to the Jews, everyone rejoiced, everyone was glad, everyone made merry. A general sense of relief has filled the city. And this should, again, be no surprise. Remember what Solomon tells us in Proverbs 29, verse 2. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked beareth rule, the people mourn. Here we see a very clear example of that. When Haman gave forth his wicked decree, the people were perplexed. They weren't happy. But now they are. Verse 16 then. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. The Jews, The notion they had light here is certainly a metaphor of sorts, as a number of commentators have noted on this verse. It's a metaphor for them having happiness, and that is certainly borne out by, for example, Isaiah 58:8. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee. The glory of the Lord shall be thy reward. But beside this general sense of happiness, I think we need to understand that the term here is being used to connote much more. Remember, light stands in contrast to darkness, and so it's going to stand in contrast to the darkness and gloom which had overspread the Jews when they had heard the publishing of that first decree from Haman. In Scripture, light has reference to salvation. It means redemption. This new news, this new edict, is like the dawning of the morning light. Now, it's been noted that this usage of the word light here is peculiar to the book of Esther. But I would suggest its peculiarity is not so peculiar, really, if we think about what's going on and why this might have been used. There's a twofold reason. When God created, in Genesis 1, he began by saying what? He said, let there be light. And here there is a recreation, a rebirth of the nation of Israel. Again, Moses is giving the account of the creation, and here Mordecai is being linked to this recreation, if you will. Now, that's the Jews, but to the Persians, everything connected with light was good. Ahura Mazda, remember him? He was a good deity who, among other things, was the god of light. He's a god of light because he is also the sun god, and that's why the importance of fire in the ancient Persian religion. So its use here might be unusual, but I think it strikes the right chord in this book. Right, to say the Jews had light is to say something like this, that they had prosperity and life set before them because they've been redeemed. Right, redemption has arisen. Psalm 27:1, the psalmist says, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? And that's what we see, I think, here, when the verse says the Jews had light. The Jews had light and gladness. This is the same word used in the previous verse to describe the fact that Shushan was glad. The word carries with it not only the notion of feeling great joy, but also displaying that great joy. And the word, because of that, might be translated jubilation. And that would include singing and other outward public acts expressive of this highest sense of joy. It appears in, for example, Nehemiah 12:43. Also, that day they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The wives also and the children rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard even afar off. That's the kind of gladness. Light and gladness and joy. Now, the difference, you might say, what's the difference between this and the former word? In Hebrew, I think it's this. This word describes the kind of joyful exultation that occurs when the people of God rejoice in God's favor. It's used, for example, in Isaiah 12:3, therefore, with joy shall you draw water out of the wells of salvation. So, the first word, gladness, maybe connotes a breaking forth into joyful acts and really has to do with that outward joy, that joyful atmosphere, if you will. Whereas this word, I think, has more to do with that inward and spiritual joy, but that too could break out in outward acts. It could show forth itself in outward acts. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. Now, this is a very interesting word. The word translated honor here signifies something honorable in the sense of being very precious. Something bought with a great price. You know, such things, we say these things are precious. We talk about precious gemstones, and things which are of great value. And this seems to describe the reaction of the Gentiles to the Jews. Now the Jews all of a sudden are esteemed as an honorable or precious people. The contrast created by this word is striking, actually. Haman had so valued his own pride, remember this? He was willing to trade great sums of money, seemingly for their demise. It wasn't because he valued them, it was because he valued his pride. The king, on the other hand, seemed to care little for the money. He was quite happy to see them destroyed for the price of nothing. So, either way we look at it, the Jews were actually accounted as a worthless people by these Persians. Therefore, it was no problem to see them utterly destroyed. But now, with this change of administration under Esther and Mordecai, the Jews seem to be held to be a people of great worth, and so, by extension, of great honor. Now, this is actually quite remarkable, isn't it? Because, as we should know, this all transpires in the course of a couple of months. Verse 17, in every province and every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. And many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. In every province and every city. As the copies of the decree spread, it moves from province to province throughout the 127 provinces. Those were the governing districts first. As it reaches each district, it's now dispersed into every city in that district. So we see in this phrase the saturation of the message of the second edict. You know, part of the kingdom is going to be left without the publication of this good news. It's going to make it everywhere. It is. Every province and every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came. These letters, these copies, are described as containing the king's commandment, his word. And this word is further characterized as a decree. That means it was an order, a law, which for the Medes and Persians was itself irrevocable. Now, although it had been devised mainly by Mordecai, it's called the king's because it travels and is proclaimed with royal dignity and protocol. As it spreads into each of these cities, it would have been read by the royal herald and perhaps attached to publicly designated places for such royal proclamations. What all of that means is something I've alluded to several times before, and that is no one would be able to gainsay the authority standing behind this edict. No one would be able to say, I didn't know this was from the king. In fact, it was almost certainly carried by posts who were marked in some respect with royal insignia. And when it was proclaimed from city to city, it would have been proclaimed with all the pomp and circumstance that would have surrounded the proclamation of any royal law. All of this is meant then to capture and hold the attention of the people as it progresses through the kingdom. They need to know. In every province, in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness. Now the same kind of jubilation, the same kind of rejoicing or exulting which had overtaken the Jews in Shushan, we're now told, fell to Jews everywhere as the news spread. So what had happened in Shushan is continuing to happen as the news reaches them. You're getting the same response. As it passes through each province, each city, the Jews in those places couldn't but help to feel the great relief of having such an ominous, what could only be regarded as an ominous sentence of death hanging over them. Especially as they heard of the provisions that they were being encouraged to make for their own defense. And all of that, remember, with the blessing of the king. So the joyfulness would be deep as they came to realize Haman is dead. And Mordecai has assumed his post. Think about that. This is, as this comes, they're being struck with this picture of a complete reversal. Totally unexpected. They had no way of knowing anything. You know, there was no internet. There was no long-distance calling. They had to wait till these guys got there. When they did, they knew there had been a major shift and change in law, in policy. So the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. The feast, the word here is the same that was used for the drinking banquets, the kind that Esther had prepared for the king and Haman. These feasts were characterized by a certain amount of drinking and merrymaking. And so everywhere, spontaneously, these feasts erupted as the Jews sought to give open expression to their joy. So then, the day that the news reached each place was accounted a good day. Now, there are some people, I think, getting ahead of themselves because they want to turn Esther into an apologetic for making holidays, and they translated this word, these words from the Hebrew, holiday. But it doesn't say holiday. It just says Yom Tov, a good day. Calling it a holiday tends to lose the significance of the sense that it was a day in which good triumphed over evil. Whether they thought about this before or not, the actual proclamation would have been tremendously cathartic. Would have been one of those moments when you have this release, you know, as soon as they hear it, there's this release of a lot of pent-up emotion and deep-seated feeling. You know, people don't, a lot of times, don't realize until there's some sort of cathartic moment what it is that has been inside of them. And then all of a sudden they'll break down in tears, or in this case, in joy. So the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. And we're told many of the people of the land became Jews. There's been a great deal of discussion on this last bit of this chapter regarding the truthfulness of the assertion. Did the Gentiles really become Jews? Or did they simply conform outwardly? Now, I want to just say, these kinds of questions, while they should be of interest to each individual concerned, they're not really a concern for us here. Whether or not this or that individual person has actually become a believer is not really something another person can answer with certainty anyway. I can't know for you, you can't know for me, with certainty. Should you be concerned whether or not you're a believer? Absolutely. It should be the most pressing concern of your life. But when we deal with one another, we're forced to deal with outward appearances. And that's where judgments of charity and probability start to come in. If someone professes to believe and joins to that profession a credible outward conversation that doesn't betray serious habitual sin, does not involve professing some sort of serious error or heresy, then we have to take such a person at his or her word that they have, in fact, become Jews or believers. I want to note as well, our text here tells us that many, not all, but many of the people of the land became Jews. Now, it said many. It doesn't mean that it was even a majority, although, you know, as we look at this in terms of type and shadow, I think that that would be the case. I'll come back to that in just a moment. But the majority, any majority, would amount to an increase in the number of Jews. Now, why I think these people were actually converted, I think the rabbis are just so anti-Gentile in some of the writings that they miss this point. But the fact is, the word used here in the Hebrew is a very unusual word, a particular word, and it means, literally, they became proselytes to the Jewish religion, or Hebrew religion. In other words, the idea is that they made application to be admitted into the nation of the Jews. That means that they were prepared to separate themselves from their Gentilic nation unto the Jews. And what that meant is this. They would submit themselves to the rite of circumcision. Now, let me suggest that this is surely something that would discourage hypocrites from joining with the Jews. I'm not saying there were no hypocrites, but I'm saying that there really isn't any reason to think that that's what's going on here. All right? Now, in addition, the reference to the land, and this is another odd reference here. The word land isn't commonly used to describe the territory of the Persian kingdom. The word land is actually a word that, for the Jews, would probably make them think of the promised land. And so I think that this signifies, in some sense, their separation from the pollutions of the heathens, the moral defilements common amongst the Gentiles, that the kind of things that would have been absent had they been in the Promised Land. I think that's what's being signified here. Many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. Here's a reason. Scripture tells us that the Lord is made known in his judgments. The word fear here actually indicates a terrifying dread. Now, if you see where this is going, there's a great law work being wrought upon them, which makes them discover in themselves an inability to please the true God. They become fearful of the outcome. Think about that. When the Gentiles in the Persian kingdom see the greatest man next to the king destroyed because he set himself against Israel. I think it might have made many of them rethink their position, don't you? They saw the God of the Jews was greater than the God of Haman, the Persian gods, and now what do they see? They see the hand of this God working more openly and quickly to bring the deliverance to the Jews. Of course, they would have heard the decree and discovered that the Lord had turned the heart of Ahasuerus to favor the Jews. Now, this shouldn't, as I said, be thought too strange a thing, because I think this part in Esther is a great foreshadowing and type of the conversion of the Gentiles into the Jewish church, or grafting into the church. Isaiah 49:6, and he said, It is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant, to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth. I think especially here we can discern a hint at the conversion of the Gentile nations right around the time of the regrafting of the Jews into the church shortly prior to the millennium. Paul says in Romans 11:15, for if the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving them be but life from the dead? And in verse 25 through 32, he goes on to say, for I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. and so all Israel shall be saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the Deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant unto them, when I shall take away their sins. As concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes. But as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sakes. For the gifts and calling of God are without repentance. For as ye in times past have not believed God, yet have now obtained mercy through their unbelief, even so have these also now not believed, that through your mercy they also may obtain mercy. For God hath concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. In conclusion then, let me just have you consider this godly meditation of one commentator, Thomas McCree, on these verses. He says, the joy felt by the Jews was greatly enhanced by the distress into which they lately had been plunged, and by the suddenness and strangeness of the transition. They felt like a sick man at the point of death when he hears a voice deliver from going down to the pit, or like a criminal expecting the hour of his execution when a pardon is put into his hand. They felt like their fathers when the Lord turned back the captivity of Zion. They were like them that dreamed, their mouth was filled with laughter and their tongue with singing. Such, my friends, will be the feeling of the ransomed of the Lord when they shall come to the heavenly Zion. The recollection of all that they've suffered here shall only serve to accent their happiness and convert it into a joy unspeakable and full of glory. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. But rejoice inasmuch as you're partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy. Amen.